partial, like the state said, there are over 50 mitzvahs and very little narrative, so to speak. So it's mamish very, very difficult. We can't really summarize the partial, so there's 106 in Torah, so actually we have to be very, very selective. Just want to mention a few things. First, let me just finish. I mentioned yesterday the issue that the Torah does not say specifically any type of exemption for women. I don't want to be marking it. Again, Chazal just assumed and state as part of the Torah Shabbal Peh that Noshim are not B'nois Milchana, women are not people who participate in battle. And yet, the problem is the Giyuk of the Lashon HaMishnah in Saita is that when it comes to a Mochemes Mitzvah, women are obligated. The language of the Gemara of the Mishnah in the Sefer Saita says that Milchemes Rishus, we have all of these exemptions that we looked at, but Milchemes Mitzvah, here's the language. Afilu chasan yotze mechedro. You pull the chasan out of the yichud room from Mochemes Mitzvah. Vakala, now this is the first part, Vakala mechupasa, and you pull the kala from under the chuppah. So that's very interesting, because that suggests, if you just read it literally, that for Mochemes Mitzvah, it's not only the guy who just got married who has to go to war, but even the kala herself. Now, even if we say that doesn't mean combat, which is entirely possible, because women are not the nice Mochama, that would indicate that, that women could possibly be conscripted to some type of national service in time of Milchemes Mitzvah. And then you'll remember that Milchemes Mitzvah, there are three types of Milchemes Mitzvah. Two of them are defunct, two of them are extinct, Amalek and the Seven Nations. But the third category of Milchemes Mitzvah is Lahoshia es Yisrael Miyad Tzor, to protect the Jewish people from their enemy. And if I then put in the Mishnah in Saita, that implies that Nashim do have a role to play. And yet, the Gedolei Yisrael have issued proclamations repeatedly that for a woman to be conscripted into the army, or even Shevut Lumi under the supervision of the government, would be considered to be something that's so connected to Bilei Arayas or Lachim Tzmias that they actually pass in Geharei Galiyahu. Again, it's difficult to understand. The Chazon Ish himself, who was the instigator of this great strict proclamation, was asked, what is the textual source? What is the source for this great prohibition? Halakhically, it's not at all clear that there is such a great prohibition. And Chazon Ish answers an answer that if one does not have a Munas Chachamim, it's very hard to believe. But on the other hand, it is a fundamental answer. And he said, the source is the fifth chalak of Shulchan Aruch. What is the fifth chalak of Shulchan Aruch? The Shulchan Aruch has four chalakim. And people ask, where in the Shulchan Aruch is this lesson? The fifth chalak of Shulchan Aruch is the intuition and the feeling of Gedolei Yisrael that are holy, that are dedicated to Hashem, that a certain type of practice would be destructive to the spiritual welfare of Klal Yisrael. Now again, this is hard for us because we tend to think, well, see, we tend to think that the difference between a gadol and any of us is he just knows more. So he knows more and I know less. But when it comes to judgments, when it comes to feelings, my feeling is as good as his feeling. You compare it to a plumber, right? A plumber knows how to fix a sink. An air conditioner guy knows how to fix an air conditioner. So gadolim, you know halacha. But the same way that a plumber's feeling on what is right for Am Yisrael wouldn't necessarily be any better than mine, it might be, but wouldn't necessarily be. So we sometimes fall into a trap. And by the way, I don't want to knock the so-called modern Orthodox, but this is 100% the modern Orthodox Hashkafa, in which they will look to Gedolim for matters of halacha, but only if the Gadol can show them a chapter and verse. Where in the Shulchan Aruch does it say X and X? But when a gadol simply kind of feels this is bad for the Jewish people, the modern person might say, well, he thinks it's bad, I think it's good. Why is his opinion any better than mine? But that is what the Chazon Ish is teaching us is not correct. That there is what is called a fifth chelak of Shulchan Aruch, that those people who devote themselves to Avodas Hashem, Yom HaMalayla, have a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's much deeper than the connection of most of us. And as a result, even when they cannot identify a halachic do or don't, their feeling as to what is right for Am Yisrael is much more in tandem with Hashem's will than the feeling that other, the rest of us might have. This is called the Emunas Chachamim, and it is a fundamental principle. Again, it's hard for us to fully understand this, because in the issue of women, for example, as I say, if you simply looked at the Shulchan Aruch, you wouldn't really find anything that would be usher. But Chazal, our modern Chachamim, understand that this was fundamentally a dangerous thing. There's a similar, to give you an analogous teaching. There's a statement by Yisrael Salanter. Maybe you've encountered this already. You know, when you learn the Rishonim, right? The Rishonim, the Rosh, the Rashba, the Ramban, and any of the Gedolei Rishonim, they sometimes want to be Mechadesh Halacha, right? They learn a sugya and they want to tell you the Halacha is so and so. Now, sometimes they will say, the Halacha is so and so, and this is my proof. They'll give you a proof. And sometimes they will just say, Nireli, it appears to me, or Mistaver, it is logical. So Mishal Salanter says, if one halacha is based on a raya, and another halacha is just based on nirali, which is considered to be a stronger halacha? So most people would say, well, if the halacha is based on a raya, that's a stronger halacha. The other is just based on an intuition. So Mishal Salanter said the opposite. When a halacha is based on a raya, the gadol is coming to that conclusion only because of one source, one proof. And proofs can always be interpreted different ways. But when a gadol has an intuition that has no proof, it is emerging from the totality of his connection to Hashem. So in a sense, that which comes out of a gadol's intuition is even stronger than that comes out of a definite proof. Because already, now this may be a little shocking to you, already the Ramban himself writes, you know, the Ramban wrote, besides the Chidushi of Ramban al Hashas, have you ever seen this? This is a very, very advanced learning, so to speak, but on the Rif, the Rif made a code, an abbreviated code, based on the Gemara. The halachas of the Rif, in back of the Gemara. The Rif is a kitzur of the Gemara. It takes out the Shafa Bataria, gives you the machlokshim, and tells you the halacha. So the Rif, the Baal HaMa'or of Zerachya Halevi, at the age of 17, wrote a bunch of criticisms of the Rif. Now that's quite amazing. The Rif was the greatest of Gedolei Ador. The Baal HaMa'or was a kid. And he attacks the Rif. He basically says, the Rif is wrong here, the Rif is wrong here. And that is called the Sefer HaMa'or. It's called the Baal HaMa'or. The Ramban wrote a Sefer to defend the Rif from the criticisms of the Baal HaMa'or. And that is called Milchamas Hashem, the Wars of Hashem. The Rabban called that a Muhammad's mitzvah, right? So now we have a fourth category of Muhammad's mitzvah. Defend the Rif against the Baal HaMa'or. And to this very day, if you look in the back of a Gemara, right, you'll have a Rif. And on every page, there'll be HaMa'or, Sefer HaMa'or, usually in block letters, and Milchamos Hashem in Rashi script, that is Ramban and Baal HaMa'or. So again, it's a very, very sadistic to understand the basis of halacha coming out of the sukkahs. Now, the Ramban wrote a hakdama to Muhammad Hashem, in which he makes a very interesting point. He says, you know, people bring rayas to their positions, right? People say things, they bring a raya to their position. But the Ramban says, you know, most rayas are never 100% ironclad. Most proofs have multiple alternative interpretations, meaning, it's very rare. I mean, when you're dealing with great Gedolei who bring proofs and they say things in opposite ways, it's not that, I mean, no Rishon is going to say something that's absolutely wrong because there's a proof totally the opposite. The Ramban said that the proofs of Halacha are not mathematical in nature. A mathematical proof is irrefutable, at least the traditional mathematics. He says Talmudic proofs are always refutable. And ultimately, it comes down to the intuition of the person who is Shapua in learning, as to what makes more sense and what not. And that's not always quantifiable. And that's where Emunas Chachamim comes in. And really, in issues like the drafting of women, for Sheirut Lumi, it is not such a quantifiable issue. And so one has to know. And again, this is a very hard thing to communicate, because those who are not committed to this type of belief will basically say, if you cannot show me in the Shulchan Aruch that something is usher, then automatically it's what? Not always the case. You know, there are things that depend on a shikul, a weighing of what is good for Kol Yisrael, what is good for your neshama, and what is bad for Kol Yisrael, what is bad for your neshama. These are not always quantifiable ideas. That's just what I wanted to say about the Yos Habonos and generally the idea of Amunas Chachamim. And now, of course, what happens when different Gedolim have different Shitas? Who do you follow? Now, that's a question for another time. Maybe we'll take it up one of our eventual Tuesday questions and answers. We haven't had one for 2 weeks, but giving you time to gather up your questions. I'm not even sure if this is working out. We'll have to be bad for a while. But we'll have it. We will have it. So who's a Gadol and who do you choose and who do you follow? Those are very, very difficult questions to be sure. But the notion that you look at a Gadol as simply a plumber or a mechanic who just knows halacha better than me, but I'm just as good as him and everything else, that is a fundamental mistake. That is really misunderstanding what it means to devote your life to Torah. When you devote your life to Torah, you are also closer to God. You are closer to Hashem. You are able to intuit truth that may elude those of us that are not on that madriga. Okay, it's not just a professional body of knowledge that somebody masters. Like somebody might study law for 100 years and not know a tremendous amount of law, but that does not transform the neshama in the way that Torah itself is pregnant. Now, in this connection, I want to mention one mitzvah in the beginning of the parasha. The first mitzvah talks about the woman that is captured in time of war. That is a very, very interesting mitzvah. The Torah seems to permit, in time of war, actually taking a woman, and a non-Jewish woman, and living with her. Let me just point out one. I don't want to talk about that so much, but I'll actually give a address it tomorrow night on that. I just want to point out one thing that one has to understand. According to Chazal, this does not refer to rape. Okay? This is not legitimating rape. Now, it is legitimating consensual, one-time intercourse with a non-Jewish woman, and if you want to keep her, she has to go through a procedure. But it is important to know, which is already very problematical, obviously, but I just want you to know that it's not as problematical as you might have thought it is. We are not talking about raping her. We are talking about a heter of consensual relations. Even that is a tremendous chiddush, and as Rashi points out, the Torah is giving you a concession against the Yetzer Hara, because in time of war, people's passions are very, very powerful, and if you don't permit it in this particular way, it will explode in improper ways. Okay. But we'll come back to that later. Now, right afterwards, the Torah gives us the mitzvah of the Ben Sorer Umorim, the rebellious son. Very, very strange mitzvah. Now, this is a kid, according to Chazal, who's not yet bar mitzvah. He's 12 and a half. He's not even bar mitzvah. He didn't do stuff as bad as you might imagine. He didn't murder anybody. Didn't rape anybody. But he stole a lot of meat and wine from his parents. And the parents schlep him to base them. That itself is already unusual. And they say, this is our rebellious son. And the Torah says, such a rebellious kid shall be stoned, put to death. Now, the Gemara already says, why are you putting him to death? All he did was steal. If an adult steals, he doesn't get put to death. And he's not even bar mitzvah, so why is he responsible for his actions? So the Mishnah says in Sanhedrin that this is an example of a case of nidon al shem sofa. Nidon al-Shem Sofa means he's not punished for what he did. He is punished for what he will do if he's allowed to go on. This is what you might call preventatively putting somebody to death in order to prevent greater sins from happening. Because based on this trajectory, first he steals, eventually he's going to rob people, and he might come to kill them. So the Torah says, Yomus Zaka, let him die when he is in a state of innocence, relatively speaking. V'yal yamos chaya, and not to die when he's in a state of guilt. It is to his spiritual benefit to take him out when he's still relatively blameless, that it shouldn't turn into the great sinner who will eventually murder people. Now, this is very unusual, and let me point out one obvious point. The obvious point is, this notion of killing somebody because of the person they will become is only a judgment God can make. There is no possible way, in other words, it's only because God said that, so Ramora, this is my judgment, God knows the future. If I, or any one of us, any person in the world, even the greatest level, to say that somebody should die because we can project and predict they're going to do sins, that would be totally evil. There was a short story that Roald Dahl once wrote, maybe you read the story, about he portrayed he didn't even tell you the year, so he didn't even know what he was talking about until the end of the story, which has a pretty remarkable punchline. Like, you're a doctor in a small village in Europe, and you get called in the middle of the night to a mother who is so distraught. And the mother is crying and sobbing, and you see that she hasn't slept for days. And she has this cute, adorable little baby that's burning up with 104 fever. And she's so afraid. This is her only child, and the child is going to die. And the woman is begging the doctor for mercy, take care of the child. And the doctor will try to save the child. Now, the punchline of the story was, let's say that you had a moment of absolute clarity, that you knew that this child was Adolf Hitler. And you knew that this child would grow up and kill 6 million Jews and a few million other people as well. What do you do? Do you say, poor little cute baby, of course, I have to take care of the baby. How can I be heartless and cruel and let a baby die? Or do you say, not only will I let this baby die, I will take a hammer and smash his brains in. Because by killing this baby, I'm going to save 10 million people. By the way, that's how you understand Amalek. People ask the question, how could the Torah say you kill Amalek, even the little babies? What type of person kills little babies? The answer is, God is telling you that little baby Amalek is going to grow up to be Hitler. Now, only God can tell you that. We can't make that judgment. That's exactly right. But when Hashem says, that's the judgment. So Ben Sora Mori is not a human judgment at all. It's a divine judgment. But here's the question. It seems to contradict God's own divine judgments. Famous question the Marsha asks. Do you remember Ishmael? Ishmael, right, Abraham banishes Hagar and Ishmael, and they're wandering in the desert. And Ishmael, the young boy, is dying of thirst. And the mother abandons him. She throws him under the bushes because she can't do anything for him. And if you remember, the angel opened her eyes, and she saw a well, and she was able to give Ishmael to drink. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says that in Shamayim, the Malachi Asharis asked God, how can you give water to this Ishmael whose descendants in the future, the Arabs, are going to come and afflict and torture the Jews? Isn't it better to let him die? This, by the way, is the Kriyas HaTorah of the first day of Rosh Hashanah. And Hashem said, Asher Hu Shav. I judge people not by what they will become. I judge people by the way they are. And right now, Yishmael, again, Yishmael is not excited, says how he was banished, but Yishmael is relatively okay. The fact that he will do, or his children will do bad things in the future, I'm not going to punish him now for what's going to happen in the future. So the Marsha asks the obvious question. It seems that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is operating in two contradictory ways. From the story of Yishmael, we see that Hashem judges you the way you are now and doesn't take into account the future. He's not going to destroy you now to prevent you from doing sin, because after all, you do have free will, even though Hashem knows how that story is going to come out. And yet, by Ben Sora and Mora, it's exactly the opposite. The Ben Sora and Mora is destroyed not because of what he did, but because of what he will do. Is that not a contradiction to the Hanhaga of Asher Husham of Yishmael? This is the Kasha of the Marsha and other Mephorshim as well. So the Marsha gives an interesting answer. The Marsha says, The rule that Hashem doesn't take into account the future means Hashem doesn't take into account the future of what your descendants are going to do. Because the enemies of the Jews were not Yishmael, it was the descendants of Yishmael. The Ben Sora of Umorah, however, his behavior is going to turn into what he himself is going to do. That Hashem will take into account. There you do have Nidim on Sheikh Sofa. That is what the Okay. But be it as it may, it's still a very unusual situation. I mean, listen, I don't know how many of you have ever broken into the liquor closet. I mean, you know, and your parents, whatever it is, not the kids. Hopefully, at least kosher, whatever it would be. So now, all of a sudden, you figure mom and dad are going to ground you or something. Oh no, go into the basement. You know, it's going to be a little shocking, I would think. You know, so in fact, there is an opinion in the Gemara that says, "Ben sore umore lo haya ulo yivre." There never was such a case. It never happened. First of all, the halakhic conditions are very exacting, and I'll discuss that. And second of all, parents normally would not bring a kid to get executed in that way. So it never happened. It's a theoretical construct as to what could happen. It's a reminder, in other words, that sometimes the habits of children can turn into really bad things. Now then, though, it's a little perplexing. After one rabbi says, this never happened and it never will happen, another rabbi says, it happened, and I sat on top of that kid's grave. Well, how do you understand that, machlokas? You know, we have a tradition, as Chazal themselves say, that whenever you have a machlokas, one says kosher, one says grave, one says tor, one says tameh, we say they're actually both right. Hashem considers both to be true. In halacha, as long as they're following the halachic rules, Hashem considers both legitimate. But how do you explain that here? One, this is not a machlokas in halacha. This is a machlokas, what happened? One person said, it never happened. The other person said, it happened and I was there. That's a pretty difficult machlokas to say, they're both right. How can they, see, you understand this? This is an important point. It's not so difficult when people say opposite things in halacha, like you might say the same question. If one says mutter and one says usser, they're both right. How can they be both right? That's also a contradiction. But that's not really so difficult. Because Hashem gave us the process of the oral law. And Hashem basically says, if the Gedolim follow the process, then I will consider whatever decision the Posek comes up with as a legitimate decision, even if they're opposites. That's not so bad. But when there's a machlokas in historical events, did it happen? How can they both be right? So, just as Pshat, the way I would suggest is the following. This just might be a very simple mahalach. That is, there actually is a machlokas regarding certain technicalities of Ben Sora and Umorah. So, it could be both opinions agree that some kid was killed by a Sanhedrin because he was a Ben Sora and Umorah. But the one that said it never happened means that, according to his halachic decision making, the kid shouldn't have been adjudicated a Ben Sora and Umorah. And therefore, it was just a murder. In other words, he was killed. According to one opinion, this was a valid execution of Ben Sora and Umorah. According to the other opinion, it was an invalid execution. And that way, it ultimately comes down to halacha. It does not come down to Messiah. Now, what are some of these technicalities? Because there's some lessons here. And this is one of the reasons why it would be so difficult to adjudicate a Ben Sora and Umorah. The Torah says that when the parents bring the kid to the Beis Din, they say, "Enenu shomeya," he does not listen, "v'kol aviv v'kol imo," to the voice of his father and mother. And it uses the word singular, kol. So the Talmud says, this teaches me that the father and mother have to have the same voice. Man and woman, they have to sound exactly the same. Well, that's pretty impossible. They say sometimes that husbands and wives of many years, they look a little bit the same because their facial expressions can actually mold to each other. People even say you can look like your dog, you look like your pet. There's such a thing, as it were. But generally speaking, the voice is not going to sound the same, right? Men's voices and women's voices are different, right? Women's voices are usually higher. So because of this, it's impossible. You're never going to have a Ben Stiller and Moira because you need father and mother's voices to be the same. But I'll come back to that. A second condition that's not so difficult, you'll probably need to get this in most cases, is that both parents have to be hearing. If one of them is deaf, there's no Ben Stiller and Moira. Now, these two conditions seem to be arbitrary. They don't particularly make any sense. One is their voice has to be the same. And two is neither can be deaf. Okay, zeres hakasuk. But I want to suggest to you that the Torah is homiletically teaching me some very deep psychological wisdom about raising children and about parenting. The Ben Sower Umora is essentially the bad seed, the irredeemable kid, the kid who has gone off the derech, in which God himself says there's no hope for him, basically. God himself says, just finish him off. You know, you have kids like that, and you know, sometimes you have these 10-year-olds that commit murders, you know, what do you do with them? There's like nothing you can do in that way. Philosophically, that is a difficult question, meaning is there such a thing as a point of no return? Is there not tshuva? Is there not free will? Is there such a phenomenon as born evil? Difficult. It's a hard question. It's not an easy question, because to assume that someone reaches a point that they're so beyond help that they just have to be written off seems to be very inconsistent with the notion of tshuva. But at least the Ben Sower and Moira is considered to be a bad kid. There's no hope. But the Torah's Meramis, before you can write a kid off, there are certain conditions that he has to be raised a certain way. That is, let's take the condition that neither parent is deaf. So what that means is following, homiletically, Derech Drush. If the parents are not listening to their own message, they can't expect the child to listen. You know the saying, when a parent says to a child, do what I say, but not what I do, that is a recipe for failure. Right? Parents want to raise their children. But I don't even have to get into religion per se, because it applies to even just raising your kids generally. I want my kid to be honest. I want my kid to be conscientious. I want my kid not to cheat. I want my kid not to lie. But when it comes to me, you know, I might lie, I might cheat. My kid gets suspended because he cheated on a test. And I gave my child a whole drasha, but I have to be honest. Then somebody calls for me, and I don't want to talk to them. I tell my son, just tell the person I'm not home. Well, you just gave your kid a drasha about being honest. Or people want their children to learn more. I remember in the United States, I was once at a meeting of the Board of Education of a day school, and the parents were discussing ways they could make their kids learn more. Now, the school day went on till 5 o'clock, and they said, well, let's have a mishmar twice a week, and this sort of thing. And the kids were tired, and these were American kids, so. You know, they're used to sports and recreational activities. So I was a little cynical because I knew exactly what some of these parents did at night, and it wasn't necessarily learning. I thought to myself, if you really want your kids to do more learning, maybe the point is not to make them do more learning, but it's maybe for you to do more learning. Because then they see you as an example, they see that you're mashkir Torah, they see that you enjoy Torah learning, and then they're going to be, you know, inspired. You inspire your child, not so much by what you tell them. You inspire your child by the type of person you are. You're an honest person, you're a charitable person, you're a person who doesn't lose his temper, who controls his anger. Then your kids will see that, and they will adopt those ways. But if you're a person who gets angry at people, if you're a person who's unkind, if you're a person that's rude, but then you give your kids drushas about all the different ways they should behave, it's not going to work. But Putner used to say that when parents talk in show, it's more of a problem in America than it is here, but when parents talk in show, and then they stop their conversation to tell their kids to keep quiet during davening, the only thing the child will learn is that when he grows up, he will tell his child not to talk during that. but he will not learn not to talk during davening because his parent has not learned not to talk during davening. So the best way to raise good children is to become a good person. Well, that's hard. The Sukkrim Lister tell us we have a Yetzer Hara for ourselves. We don't have a Yetzer Hara for our children. When it comes to us learning, us davening, us doing mitzvahs, we have a Yetzer Hara. When it comes to getting my kid to do mitzvahs, I don't have a Yetzer Hara. So it's much easier for me to put things on him to do than to do it myself. But unfortunately, this would be bad news for me to give you. Now, sometimes Hashem gives you a matana. Sometimes you can have a kid who has awful parents, and the child becomes a real child. It can happen. But no parent has a right to expect that. You can't expect your children to be tzaddikim unless you work on yourself to be tzaddikim. Sometimes Hashem, whatever, gives you a special freebie, a special gift, and you'll have really, really phenomenal children, even if you're not working on yourself. But that's rare. That's a special gift in Hashem. So, you understand this? This is the homiletical message. Before I can write off this kid and say he is beyond hope, we have to have parents who are not deaf to their own message. Because if the parents are deaf to their own message, it's not the kid's fault. It's the parents' fault. So homiletically, the idea that if the parents are deaf, the kid cannot be a Ben Sohar Umoga could be understood symbolically. If the parents are deaf to their own message, they behave inconsistently with what they say, you can't write off the kid. The kid simply didn't have a role model to whom he can emulate. Now, by the same token, we could say this is the meaning that the father and mother's voice must be the same. Halachically, it does in fact mean the voice has to sound the same, which would almost never happen. But allegorically, because the Torah is understood on multiple levels, allegorically, it means before you can write off the kid, the father and mother must be on the same page. In other words, their voice must be the same means there must be a consistency of message. Now, this is an interesting point. It is, of course, the case that father and mother, men and women generally, have different styles and different interactions. And that's exactly right. It's not supposed to be the case that father and mother interact with their children exactly the same way. Depending on the home, the historical way was mom was the softie and dad was the disciplinarian, the old... the 1950s, you know, wait till your father gets home, type of thing. Now, and for whatever reason, the household tends to be the opposite. Even in from household, the mother tends to be stricter than the father. Some differentiate. Fathers are stricter on sons, and mothers are stricter on daughters, you know, whatever the psychological aspect is. But I'm not talking about different parenting styles. I'm not talking about softer, stronger, more disciplined, less disciplined. That's built into the system. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made men and women differently because men and women do interact differently. But there has to be a consensus on the fundamental values of what is a Torah life, what is important in life. So once again, if the kid is hearing one thing from one parent and one message from another parent, once again, you can't label the child a Ben Sohar Umoga because he's just hearing different messages all the time. And therefore, the two messages of these technical halachas, the parents cannot be deaf to their own teaching, and they have to be consistent in the messages, are really guidelines in parenting, guidelines in Jewish parenting. I know it's a little early for you guys, but in Rish Hashem, you will face these challenges, you will have these challenges, and these are things to remember. The point is not for men and women to be the same, they are absolutely different. That's fine. But there has to be an agreement on fundamental values. That what is important in life? What are we mashiv in life? What is the basis of our home? What is the type of child that we want to have and raise?
So I was just thinking, like, how the parent is son and mashiv. How would that not exactly be one of his kids?
In other words, Chizkiyahu's son Menashe?
Yeah, sorry, Chizkiyahu's.
Well, indeed. Menashe is considered to be a great day to Russia. That's why, you're saying he shouldn't have been?
I mean, I don't know what they're doing with Dagzin.
Well, Menashe was not executed as a Ben Sorer Moer, because, you know, maybe he didn't do the technical, he didn't steal, I mean, you know, that is a technical thing you got to do. But again, Menashe is considered to be a Russia because, indeed, he had wonderful, righteous parents. Although I will tell you this, Menashe is an interesting case. Okay. Menashe is a very interesting case. Let me digress a little moment on that. It was a fascinating thing. I know that one of the inadequacies in our yeshiva curriculum is that Bachrim and Yom Yolaita, Reichen, don't really learn Tanakh very well. Maybe Chumash they try, but when it gets to Nevi'im and Ketuvim, you know, it kind of falls by the wayside, which is, you know, sad, it's unfortunate a little bit. I myself, when I was in yeshiva, did not learn a lot of Tanakh. I tried to learn it afterwards, but, you know, it's good to learn it if you can. And one of the Svarim of Tanakh, that is a very neglected sefer, is the sefer Divrei Hayomim, which is Chronicles. And Chronicles is a very perplexing sefer, because Chronicles seems to be a rehashing of the books of Shmuel and Malachim. So every story in Shmuel and Malachim is rewritten in Divrei Hayomim. And you've got two problems. When it's rewritten the same way, you have Akasha, why are you repeating it? And when it's rewritten a different way, you have contradictions, you have a problem. Why are there contradictions? So you're not going to win it. Divrei Hayomim is going to be a problem no matter what. It's either repetitive or it's contradictory. Big problem. I'm not going to address that systematically, you know, what is it? But one of the very, very fascinating contradictions in Divrei Hayomim and Malachim is the treatment of Menashe. In the book of Malachim, if you remember, there was a very, very righteous king, Chizkiyahu HaMelech. And he was a great, great tzaddik. He could have been the Mashiach. Had the generation been worthy, he could have been the Mashiach. This was before the Churban of the first place of it. He could have been Mashiach. That is when Sancheirib, after he exiled the 10 tribes, was going to destroy Yerushalayim, and miraculously, Yerushalayim was saved in the merit of Chizkiyahu HaMelech. But he was so righteous, and he was also a Navi, he didn't want to get married. Because he knew with Ruach HaKodesh that the son that he would have would be a tremendously bad person, or Russia, Menashe. And he got sick, and he was going to die, and the Navi Yeshayahu went to him and said, you are going to die because you are not fulfilling the mitzvah of Brewer Ruach. And when Chizkiyahu said, but the son I will have will be a Russia, Yeshayahu HaNavi told him, it is none of your business to look into the future. You have a mitzvah. You do the mitzvah, no matter what. So you know what happened? Yeshayahu actually gave Chizkiyahu his own daughter to marry, in the hope that perhaps that would produce a tzaddik. And yet, unfortunately, Chizkiyahu was right. The child was Menashe, and Menashe had the longest reign of any king of Am Yisrael. Menashe became king at the age of 12, and he ruled for 55 years. There was no king who had as long a reign as Menashe. And he was an Oved Avodah Zarah, he was a Rotzeach. He did all the evil things in the eyes of God. Not only that, according to Chazal, he killed his own grandfather. He killed the prophet Yeshayahu, who died as a martyr through Menashe. Now, this is both in Malachim and in Divrei Hayomim. But here is the interesting contradiction. When I read the book of Malachim, Menashe lived as a Russia, died as a Russia, there is nothing good to be said about him at all. He just died as a Russia. According to the Gemara in Sanhedrin, he does not have a share in Olam Haba. If I read the book of Divrei Hayomim, I get a whole other additional story that's not even in Malachim at all. You would never have heard of it. That is, towards the end of his life, he was kidnapped by the Babylonians, and he did tshuva in prison, and he escaped and came back, and he lived the rest of his life as a righteous tzaddik who returned to Hashem with all of his heart and all of his soul. This is a pretty big contradiction. I read the book of Malachim. Menashe was a Russia mitzchila v'yatzof. I read the book of Divrei Hayamim, Menashe did tshuva and died serving Hashem with all of his heart and all of his soul. They're both in Tanakh. They're both Kadosh. They're both Dennis. How could they both be right here? You got a real problem. So let me tell you a beautiful teretz that one of the following Musar says. That Menashe's sins have two different impacts. On one hand, Menashe's sins are his own sins. He committed sins. He committed evil. On the other hand, because he was the king, he inspired others to emulate his ways. Because the king is a role model. People look at the king, oh, he can do it, I can do it. In other words, he was not only a chote, he was not only a sinner, but he was machtias harabim. He caused Am Yisrael to sin. Now, the book of Malachim is describing Menashe in his role as king. The book of Divrei Hayamim is describing Menashe in his role as individual Jew. Individual Jew sins? Individual Jew does tshuva? Baruch Hashem, as an individual, I repented, God forgives me. But here is the problem. Yeah, Menashe did tshuva. But what about the 100,000 or 200,000 or 2 million people who were led astray because of his averus? His tshuva doesn't change them. So the same Aveira can be looked at under two different perspectives. Menashe qua individual did tshuva. But Menashe as a chayte yomachti as a rabbin, there's no tshuva for that. You know, it's reminiscent of the famous story that somebody asked the Chavetz Chaim, how do you do tshuva if you speak Lashon Hara about somebody? I spoke Lashon Hara about somebody. How do I do tshuva? The Chavetz Chaim says, I'll tell you exactly what you do. Take an old pillow that's filled with feathers. You know, we used to stuff the pillows with feathers. Climb up on a roof on a windy day. I'm giving you a Chassidish way of doing tshuva. Shake the pillow, and all the feathers fly out. So then the person says, and then what? Oh, when you can put the feathers back into the pillow, that's how you do tshuva for Lashon Hara. What does he mean? Once the Lashon Hara is out there, how do you do tshuva? The damage is done. Now, keep in mind that if this story is true, it will be like 150 years ago. Now that you have an internet and a World Wide Web in which any little piece of denigrating gossip can go to millions of people. By the way, there have been more than one suicide because of this. Different things people put on Facebook and like personal information that was humiliating and embarrassing. There are people who have killed themselves because of this. So it's not just Lashon Hara per se, it's not his precision that some of these disclosures have happened. So this is a fascinating thing about Menashe, that you have both Menashe as the Yachid can do tshuva, Menashe as the Melech cannot do tshuva. That's a big reminder that, you know, when we cause other people to sin, our tshuva doesn't really fix that. There's still that has to be fixed. And that could be a lot more difficult. Okay, so that's the point about Menashe that I wanted to share with you. Okay, you have a good week. It's Shabbos.